Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do approaches to immigration differ around the world? And what can the U.S., with its long history as a nation of immigrants, either teach or learn from countries that have more recently become destinations for international migrants? SMU's Tower Center for Political Studies and the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas this week are co-hosting a conference called Immigration Policy in the Era of Globalization. Joining us to talk about some of the issues up for discussion are my three guests this afternoon. Joseph Shammy is director of the Center for Migration Studies in New York. James Hollifield is director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at SMU. And Pia Arrhenius is research officer and senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Welcome all of you to THINK.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
It's so interesting to consider the differences between countries like the U.S. and Canada, which have, aside from native populations, really been built upon immigration, and then these countries that these days are becoming targets and have never had to deal with these issues before. When did those European countries start to be targets of immigration?
Okay. This is Jim Hollifield of the Tower Center. There are no countries really in Europe equivalent to the United States, Canada, or Australia. The reason there's a difference is because immigration was not part of the founding moment or the founding ideal for these countries. I mean, if you take France, for example, it's important to note that the French, during the French Revolution, were the first country in Europe to give citizenship to Jews, for example. So the French were expansive early on with respect to minorities and with respect to immigration, but it's not really part of their founding ideal. Having said that, the French do have a long history of immigration going back into the 19th century. They're one of the older countries of immigration in Europe. Germany, by contrast, really never thought of itself as an immigration country. Even as late as the 1980s, Germans still said, wir sind kein Einwanderungsland. We are not a country of immigration. We cannot be. That's not part of who we are, what defines us. But we all know that Germany imported a lot of guest workers starting in the 1960s. These guest workers, the guests came to stay. They stayed. They settled. So Germany ends up with millions of immigrants. And they've been struggling with how to assimilate and integrate those immigrants ever since. Contrast this with the United States, where this is part of our founding ideal, part of our founding myth. You know, and we've got all these symbols that represent that, including, of course, the Statue of Liberty and the inscription on the statue, which is, give me your tired, your poor, your hungry, teeming masses yearning to breathe free, etc.
Obviously, this is something we're still struggling with in this country and exactly how to get the balance right. And one thing that is often debated is how educated we ought to expect immigrants to be when they come to this country and what contributions they might make and what the balance is between skilled workers and unskilled workers. Do you want to comment on that, Pia?
Yes. I mean, I think that in the U.S., we have some imbalances, and I think that's because we have some official policies that dictate legal immigration, and then we have some unofficial policies that have allowed a lot of unauthorized immigration. I think in the end, what we've ended up doing with large amounts of unauthorized immigration is restricting high-skilled immigration, which tends to be legal, and not restricting low-skilled immigration, which tends to be unauthorized. So we really are, you know, have ended up in a bit of a pickle in terms of the education distribution of our immigrants.
I was really astonished when I was doing my research, and I don't know if this number corresponds to what you all have heard, but 27% of the doctors and 5% of the nurses working in this country today are foreign-born. And it made me wonder whether in our future there will be a time when we are actively competing for immigrants.
Yes, that's a case right now, and many people have written books about brain gain and how many professionals we need, especially in the medical profession, doctors, nurses, and other technicians in the high-tech areas. This is nothing new. We've benefited greatly from immigrants coming from other areas, not only the high-skilled but the low-skilled. And Europe's in the same position. Many of the nurses and physicians in the UK are coming from Africa and Asia. And this will continue. People who are high-skilled and have valuable skills in demand will be easily picked up in the market. The difficulty comes in, of course, is those people that are not marketable, mm-hmm. that are trying to come into the wealthier countries. And that's the big issue facing many of these countries, and not legal migration so much as it is the illegal or undocumented migration that's the big concern for most countries, not only in North America, but also in Europe, Africa, and Asia.
Is the stratification in Europe similar to what it is here, where you have high-skilled immigrants that are well-educated, relatively well-off, and then at the lowest tier you have people coming in to do these sort of manual labor jobs that native-born residents of all these countries don't want to take?
I would say not exactly. Jim, you can follow up on this a little bit. But I would say in Europe, the situation is quite different because they have a protected low-skilled sector with very high union wages. So with these high wages, it's kind of hard for low-skilled immigrants in Europe to actually make inroads into low-skilled occupations, at least in some countries. Less so maybe in recent years in the UK and Ireland and Sweden. But still, again, many industries are protected by union and other wage agreements. So with low-skilled making fewer inroads, a lot of times they've also been excluded by policies that have excluded them from the labor market in Europe. And that's another problem. In fact, what they found in Europe is it's much harder to integrate immigrants if you're not allowing them to work. Mm-hmm. And they've partly had those policies because they want to protect native workers. But then, of course, if immigrant would-be workers are not allowed in the labor force, then you have to support them some other way. And so they've had many more immigrants on welfare than we've had in the United States. What's refreshing in the United States, I think, is that we've always allowed immigrants access into the labor market. Certainly sometimes, even though it's against the law, we haven't mm-hmm. enforced the law. But immigrants in the labor market is actually a really good way to integrate immigrants.
Yeah, there's an old joke about Germany and the U.S. that the worst thing that can happen in Germany is you have a refugee who arrives and gets into the labor market and takes a job. Hmm. Whereas in the United States, it's exactly the opposite. For us, the nightmare is you have people who come in, let's say, as a refugee or asylum seeker, and they don't get a job and they don't become self-sufficient. So it is a pretty sharp contrast, as Pia said, between the way labor markets work in Europe and the way they work here. Having said that, there are countries in Europe which have very large clandestine populations, especially in southern Europe and Italy and Spain and Greece, what Winston Churchill once called the soft underbelly of Europe. Of course, this is the first port of call of entry for many Africans coming north, and many of them keep going, head to France or Germany or elsewhere. So I would just point out one other thing with respect to labor markets. Of course, in Europe, you do have a fairly integrated European labor market. So you have people moving around within Europe from east to west, from north to south. So that's also a big difference with the United States.
The other important aspect is to keep in mind is the demographic aspect. Mm-hmm. The world is adding about 79 million people annually. Now, the number of migrants moving is a relatively small number of the total population, several million every year, and the U.S. gets about half of them. But the demand for people to migrate to the wealthier nations and wealthier regions, not only Europe and North America, but Australia and the Persian Gulf, is so large that it overwhelms the supply overwhelms the demand in these countries. If there are tens of millions that want to enter, but you can only accept a fraction of that, how do you choose who gets in? And that's where the politics comes in and the difficult issues. Can they come in illegally? Can they come as family members? Do you choose workers? Do you choose high-skilled? All those issues come to bear, and countries have to deal with that in a very difficult environment.
The Persian Gulf region is really interesting because my understanding is in most of that area, immigrants come in from other places, but they are not – there is no path to citizenship.
They're not immigrants in their views of those host countries. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're contract workers.
Right.
It's like you
– may be there for 20 years, but you're a contract worker.
You come in to repair someone's roof, and then you leave. These mm-hmm. people come in to work. They build the building, and they're supposed to leave. As it turns out, some stay 10, mm-hmm. 20 years. They have children. Mm-hmm. But they're not immigrants in their view. They're contract workers. They're coming in to do a service or produce a product or work there, and then they're supposed to leave. Otherwise, if you did let them settle, it would change the culture of the population. Some of these countries have 70-80% of their population are immigrants. That would never – I mean, the numbers we have in this country are just a small fraction.
I think in the United Arab Emirates, 85% of the labor force is foreign, 85%.
And I guess, you know, there are probably pros and cons to doing it this way. But if you have people that are not expected to stay, a lot of what they're earning has to leave the country right away in the form of remittances, which is an issue here, especially with a lot of Latino immigrants.
Well, remittances, you can look at it from two perspectives. I guess the remittances really is the fruit of the migrant labor. And actually, if you look at a global perspective, you want migrants to remit money home. I mean, you want people to remit money from rich countries to poor countries. That's sort of what we want. That's going to further economic development and really help poor countries. And we've seen remittances do a lot of good in the world. Of course, you hear other experts who say that, you know, they deplore remittances by saying, well, they should spend their money here in the U.S. But I think that's a short-sighted, you know, view of the problem. In fact, if we want international immigration to accomplish anything, it should accomplish through capital flows and labor flows. You want it to accomplish, you know, reduction of poverty in the world as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you look at remittances to Mexico from the United States, for example, if you want to know what the biggest development program is in Mexico, it's called immigration to the United States, because the money that is sent back home, it reached well into the $20 billion plus range at its height, which dwarfs any kind of official development assistance, mm-hmm. you know, foreign aid that we're sending to Mexico. So remittances are key. I mean, a country like the Philippines, for example, has a policy of exporting its people in order to reap the benefits that come from the remittances are sent back home. And eventually the people who come back with skills and return home, which also help to develop the country.
In terms of the immigrants who are here, does sending remittances, though, make it harder to sort of assimilate and have the same amount of money as the people next door who don't have relatives somewhere else that they're helping to support?
The issue of remittances is in the top five problems in the area of immigration. Mm-hmm. Most Americans and Europeans say, the person made the money, it's up to them. They can spend it any way they want.
Right.
If they want to buy a car, or if they want to build a house, or if they want to send it to their mother or children, that's up to them. So that is not really an issue. Those people that are here that are sending remittances, of course, have difficulties because they have less income to spend and to integrate within the community. But many of them, including many of us who are second, third generation, many of our parents and grandparents intended to go back. They found it difficult to go back, and they stayed. And this thing has been going on for many, many years. Chinese, the Japanese, and now we have Asians and Africans coming. Many plan to go back, but they eventually stay because their children become settled and make lives for themselves here.
Well, also, they're building wealth. Whether it's here or there, they're building wealth. A lot of remittances are savings and investments in the home country. So they may be building a house in the home country where they want to retire to. And so you can't, you know, their combined wealth is, you know, the aggregate across where they are, the host country and their home country.
Do we need low-skilled immigrants in this country?
Depends who you ask.
I would ask Pia Arrhenius.
Let's go around the room.
Depends who you ask.
I would ask Pia Arrhenius for starters as a labor economist. Pia.
Oh, well, thank you, Jim. So do we – well, need – there's really no definition of need in economics. So it's hard to use the word need. But certainly low-skilled immigrants have immensely benefited the U.S. economy, clearly for many reasons. One reason is that the U.S. population, the native-born workers, are becoming more and more skilled over time. So we have declining numbers of low-skilled native-born workers. Some people are surprised to hear that. But over time, U.S. workers are becoming more and more educated. So we have a gap in that sense on the low-skilled end of the native-born education distribution. And so in fields like construction, agriculture, food service, those type landscaping, domestic employment, that those types of fields are really dominated by immigrants in many parts of the country. And I think it's because they are fulfilling a real need, if I can use that term. At the same time, however, that the economic benefits to low-skilled immigration are there, a lot of times the debate misses the fiscal cost of low-skilled immigration, which can be substantial, because just as with low-wage native workers or individuals, low-wage foreign workers, as they stay over time, have children and so forth, they do require public services, which cost taxpayer money.
We will get responses to this question from the two gentlemen on our panel in just a moment. We're going to take a break first. We are talking this week with participants in the Immigration Policy in an Era of Globalization conference sponsored by the Tower Center and the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. If you want to join us, call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Thank you.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with participants in the conference Immigration Policy in an Era of Globalization, sponsored this week by the Tower Center and the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. My guests are Pia Arrhenius, Research Officer and Senior Economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Joseph Shammy, Director of the Center for Migration Studies in New York, and James Holifield, Director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at SMU. We got such a rousing response to the question of whether or not we need immigrants, and I am not an economist, so I will continue to throw that word out. Joseph, do you want to give us your take on that?
Originally, you were asking about low-skilled.
Low-skilled immigrants, excuse me, yes.
This really depends on whom you're asking, which perspective you're looking at. We're very fortunate. The U.S. has a fertility level at replacement, so our population continues to grow. If we bring in immigrants, of course, accelerates that, and that means we're going to have a much larger population by mid-century, over 400 million as opposed to about 310 million now. So the issue of need really depends on who's talking. If you're an auto worker and more immigrants come in, you have more competition. On the other hand, if you're the employer, more immigrants and labor reduces labor costs generally. So it all depends on who you're speaking with, but there are costs and benefits to each side. As a demographer, many of these countries that we're talking about in Europe, as Jim was talking about, have very low fertility rates. And in order for them to stabilize their population or to stabilize their workforce, they're in need of immigrant labor. That would be clearly a need, demographically speaking.
Young labor in particular. Excuse me for interrupting.
Most employers want young people. Mm-hmm. They're cheaper. They're usually more energetic, usually. And the costs are less in terms of the benefits and so on. So they're looking for people in the mid-20s, 30s, and so on. They have a longer term they can work for the companies, mm-hmm. and they can also start families and get established.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I would like to draw Pia back into the discussion a little bit. I mean, the question of whether these workers are substitutes for native-born American workers or whether they are complements. Of course, are they coming here? Are they taking jobs that might otherwise go to native workers? Or are they filling a niche, a hole in our labor market, which would not get filled if they were not here? My understanding of the literature is that they are complements, really, that there are places in our labor market where we would have to change our economy, change the way we do business if we do not have access to immigration. Now, Phil Martin, who is also participating in this conference, another labor economist, he is a specialist on agriculture. And if he were here, he would say, well, if we didn't bring all these workers to pick the crops, we would be mechanizing this. We would be putting a lot more capital into that, and we wouldn't need those unskilled workers. So, again, it's a little what Joe was saying. I mean, it depends on your perspective. But if you're a large fruit and vegetable farmer, grower, and you got to bring that crop in out of the field, you don't want somebody saying to you, well, we're cutting off your access to workers that are going to pick those crops. Go out and spend the money to get the machines to mechanize this. But I think the literature would tell us that foreign workers in this country, immigrant workers, are complements, not really substitutes for native-born workers.
I think, again, Joe and Jim are right in the sense that it depends who you ask. There are these distributional aspects to immigration, particularly low-skilled immigration. So at the end of the day, the economic theory of immigration shows that there's an economic surplus. So income goes up for natives when there's immigration. So that's called the immigration surplus. So it's a net benefit for us on the economic or the labor market impact side. And the main reason for that is that the gains to the employer are also the gains to the consumer.
Yeah.
We gain because costs of the products and services that we're using go down. So that's the gain to the consumer.
But there's differential gains and losses depending on which group you're looking at. Pia and Jim are correct. The net gain, but localities, different groups, the people at the low end of the occupational structure have to carry heavy burden. Those border states that are carrying local costs for medical and schooling and others, they have to carry a disproportionate burden. So it, not only in terms of who's coming in, when they're coming in, but who's carrying the burden, where it's occurring. So you cannot only talk about the averages. You have to look at the distribution. And that's why we see Arizona and the border states, many of them, feeling the burden much greater than, say, a place like Vermont or Michigan. The average gains hide a great deal of regional and income and educational level distribution effects.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was referring to the economic or the labor market impacts. That's where you have the net gain. And then I always talk about the fiscal costs. I think that's very important. I think that's something that's often left out. And I think that's what Joe is mainly referring to. There are the distributional impacts on the labor market side. But on net, on the labor market side, there's a gain. But it's offset by the fiscal costs of low-wage labor because they need public services like health care, which a lot of times to low-skilled immigrants are working in jobs that they cannot afford to take up health care insurance or they are not offered health care insurance. And so the taxpayer pays those costs. So that's a real cost which I think is missing from the calculation when we do immigration policy.
So if we're looking at the fiscal and economic impacts of immigration, obviously we have to distinguish between skilled and unskilled. Does it make any sense at all to distinguish between legal and illegal, at least for purposes of addressing those two issues?
Not so much for the fiscal impact. Actually, you know, a lot of the public discourse experts like to, and many others like to, you know, accuse unauthorized immigrants for being imposing a large fiscal cost. But actually, if you take a legal low-skilled worker and an unauthorized low-skilled worker, the legal one is actually a lot more costly because he's can typically qualify for welfare programs, which the unauthorized worker cannot. So they're actually on the fiscal side a little bit cheaper than legal low-skilled labor.
Does that explain why we haven't yet found a solution to the issue of illegal immigration?
You have to wonder. You have to ask yourself why we haven't done anything about unauthorized immigration for so many years.
There are just too many people, too many firms benefiting from illegal immigration. The cost of labor is the driving force. Contractors, day laborers, nannies, fruit pickers, labor in the back rooms. You can go on and on and on. And that issue of legality is the central issue in this whole debate in most of the countries. If you see surveys throughout Europe, North America, Australia, that line between legality and illegal immigration is the big issue. You have smaller issues dealing with how many and if they should be family-oriented or skill-based and so on. But the real one that gets into the gut of most of the people is this issue of legality, especially for people, Americans, who are generally law-abiding and want the rule of law to be applied. And that's where the debate occurs now.
There's also a question when you look at legal immigrants of, okay, so you have authorized one person to come in and assume that they have skills that can fill a job that is sitting open. And then there's the question about a spouse and children and in-laws and brothers. We spoke to Kim Beazley this week, the Australia's ambassador to the United States, who said that it may be challenging to get in the first place, but once you're in Australia as an immigrant, it's quite easy to bring in large numbers of extended family members. What are the pros and cons of a policy like that with regard to how well a country does that accepts large numbers of immigrants?
Well, I think almost, Joe can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I think almost every major immigration country in the world, those receiving immigrants, do respect the right of family reunification. That is, the family should have a right to live together. I think this is even inscribed in the European Charter of Human Rights, if I'm not mistaken. So the Europeans accept this, the Americans accept this, and it is true that those who say, well, let's freeze or let's stop all immigration, the Europeans tried that in the 1970s, an immigration stop. But what they found, of course, is when you freeze it, when you stop it like that, people then do stay. They settle. They're not going to go back. They're not going to move back and forth. And then the family reunification kicks in because they're going to, if they can't go back, then they're going to start bringing in their family members. So family, this is part of a process, a sort of chain migration that occurs. This is just part of the phenomenon of migration itself.
It depends also on the country you're looking at, as Jim's saying. The U.S. is like two-thirds are family immigrants, and Canada it's the reverse, two-thirds are skilled. Mm-hmm. But countries have very, very different positions.
Yep.
First of all, some countries, if the worker, she comes in and she gets pregnant, they ship her out.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries, we're having complications, even this country, what's a family? If a homosexual couple get married in the Netherlands and or an American gets married to someone in Argentina and they want to bring in their spouse, the same sex, that's in the courts right now. Many countries have problems of that. Mm-hmm. What is the definition of the family? That opens up a whole can of worms. Is it only the minor mm-hmm. children? Is it the first marriage, second marriage? How many wives?
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes very complicated. But in general, Jim said it's correct. Most mm-hmm. of the countries, especially European, American, Australian, if he comes in and you're an immigrant, they have a legitimate right to bring in your family members, your spouse and children.
Although I will follow up on that and say there are large differences between countries. I guess, Joe, you mentioned this. But so in the U.S., 85% of our permanent resident visas go to family and humanitarian, and only 15% of permanent resident visas or green cards go to employment-based immigrants, mm-hmm. of which half of those are spouses and children. So 7% of our green cards go to employment-based, highly mm-hmm. skilled workers, which you have to question. If you look at the OECD data, which looks at other countries and compares us in terms of our priorities, we are an outlier. Yeah. We are the nation that brings in most, the highest share family in our permanent program for permanent visas. And so why are we such an outlier? And I think a lot of nations are reconsidering how much family they bring in. Mm-hmm. And I think probably in the U.S. it's something that we should consider as well.
Yeah, if you look at the Canadian system, I mean, the Canadians have a point system, and you do get certain points for if it's a relative, but you also get points for education and other things. So, I mean, if you think of this in sort of a rational policy term, I agree with Pia. I mean, family should play a role, but it shouldn't be as dominant as it is in the United States. Having said that, if you opinion surveys of Americans, most Americans want immigration slowed. They want it cut. But when you point this out that, well, who do we go after among the family members? Do we stop the grandparents? Do we go after the brothers and sisters? And then you'll see Americans are much more ambivalent about this. Well, but wait a minute. I mean, we can't stop people from bringing in, you know, close family members. We can't break up families. So there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence about this in the United States. But Pia is absolutely right. You know, the reason we have a lot of illegal immigration in this country is because we don't allocate enough visas for people to come and work here. It's as simple as that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Excellent program, as always. I have a very short comment, then a question. For over 20 years, I've been representing brave people seeking asylum here in the United States, and it's something that is almost never even mentioned in the conversation about immigration. And I'd like your panelists to discuss or comment on the unique needs of asylum seekers seeking refuge here in the United States. And listen to your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call.
You bet.
The question dealing with asylum is a very different question than the issue of this international migration and immigration. It's kept separately. There's a separate UN agency, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a whole set of protocols and rules following that. And the U.S. is a signatory of that protocol and bills, and we respect that, and many of the countries around the world do. So they're treated very, very differently. The difficulty comes in, though, is assessing which ones are legitimate refugees, and that's the debate that's going on now in Italy, France, throughout Europe. We have many people who can't get into countries, and they try to come in and as asylum seekers and refugees, and then they have to go through the process. As I mentioned earlier, the supply of potential migrants coming to countries far exceeds the demand. Therefore, the only avenue they can come into many of these countries are as asylum seekers and refugees. The U.S. has a long, very, very impressive history of how we're dealing with refugees in the past, and I think that will continue here. Now, some people may say we need to do more, but relative to other countries, I think we're doing a very good mm-hmm. job.
I would just take partial exception with what Joe just said about the U.S.'s long and distinguished record. I mean, we did not have an asylum or refugee policy per se. You know, those who look back in history remember that we turned away a lot of Jews, for example, sent them back to their death in Europe during the 30s and 40s. And then in the 50s and 60s, right up into the 1970s, our policy was driven largely by the Cold War, by foreign policy. If you were fleeing a communist country, you were allowed here almost automatically. I look at the Cubans, for example, who we still today have a special provision for the Cubans. But in 1980, we did finally put into our law the Geneva rules on refugees and asylum seekers, which says if you have a well-founded fear of persecution, you cannot be sent back to the country that you're fleeing. This is the principle of non-refoulement. It's a French term. You cannot send somebody back. Doesn't mean you have to take them, but you can't send them back if you've signed this treaty. And the U.S. is a signatory of the treaty. And we are – I would agree with Joe that we've been fairly generous since that time once we put this in our law. So it is treated separately. And I would just add one final thing about this. As tempting as it is to mix political and economic refugees, we have to maintain we have to strive to maintain that distinction because we have to protect people who are genuinely threatened and who need to move. And if we mix the two, then it undermines the refugee regime itself.
I was surprised to learn that the majority, and I don't remember the exact figure, so forgive me, but the majority of international migrants in the world today go from developing country to developing country.
Yes, true.
I suppose, are they what would motivate that kind of lateral migration?
There are several reasons. Some of it has to do with conflicts.
Sure, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, and we have a large number of conflicts around the world, as you know. And some of it has to do with economic opportunities, resources, labor, and movements in Africa, South America, and throughout Asia. You have huge populations there. We have about 1.1 billion people in the developed world, and the remaining of this almost 6 billion people in the developing world. So it makes sense that you can have more people moving across those borders. Also, those borders are much more porous often mm-hmm. than the ones we're talking about. Mm-hmm. In Europe, you have a large bodies of water surrounding it. In Africa and Asia and South America, you have land borders which can be easily crossed. And it's difficult sometimes for documentation as well in those countries, mm-hmm. who's going in between the Congo and Angola or between Sudan and Egypt. Mm-hmm. How do you ascertain who's who, mm-hmm. asking for papers? So there are many, many forces operating. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the information, most of the people want to come to the wealthier countries of the North if you ask them. And despite the fact that the U.S. has had problems with refugees in the past, still most of them want to come to the U.S.
My guests this hour are Joseph Shammy, who is director of the Center for Migration Studies in New York, James Hollifield, who's director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at SMU, and Pia Arrhenius, research officer and senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas. All are participating in this week's Immigration Policy in an Era of Globalization conference. If you'd like to join the conversation, we will take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are James Hollifield, Pia Arrhenius, and Joseph Shammy. All three are participating in this week's conference, Immigration Policy in an Era of Globalization, sponsored by the Tower Center and the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Drew in Irving. Hello, Drew.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in regards to kind of agricultural areas, and you were talking about kind of redistributing the money to help the impoverished areas. I'm from Montana originally. I remember reading an editorial a few years ago discussing the census and how in those areas most of the low-skilled positions are held by high school students, things like that, and that money is returned back to that local community. Where in a case we have a lot of remittances, they're leaving the country, and that actually puts a burden on a lot of those social services, which in the census, they're so migratory that those local areas oftentimes are not included with that population. You understand my kind of question about how does that affect the local community where there's not that redistribution within the local community of wealth?
Yeah, and before we get your answer, Drew, how many years ago was it that communities were essentially having their agricultural work done by local high school students? Was that decades ago? Was it just a few years ago?
If you go back to Montana, you will see the majority of low-skilled positions like at high school, like McDonald's or a lot of summer jobs are working in the farms.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get an answer for you. Thank you so much for your call. Anybody want to?
Yeah, I mean, I can fill in. In terms of remittances, I mean, what we see, this goes back to what we were mentioning earlier. Yes, I mean, critics contend that immigrants should be spending all their money here to help, you know, our economy. But if you look at the global perspective, I mean, we have poor countries and we have rich countries. This is a rich country. And actually what you want is really for there to be redistribution. People, if they want to save their money or, you know, send their money to their relatives in poor countries, then actually that's a better outcome for the world as a whole. I think you have to view it that way. The other thing I wanted to note is over time, you know, initially when immigrants come, they do remit substantial portions of their income back home. But over time, that goes away. As they settle and establish their families here, they invest more of their money on this side of the border.
Do remittances slow immigration from the country to which they're sent?
I don't think so. There's a debate on this. Remittances, they have a lot of beneficial developmental effects. They've been shown to increase schooling that mm-hmm. children get back home. But they've also shown to, you know, when remittances flow in, people are less likely to work in the home country. Mm-hmm. So if the spouse is receiving remittances, she's less likely to work. So that can be seen as a negative. And I think, but overall, remittances have been shown to reduce poverty rates, which is the big benefit.
I think it's important for Drew to keep in mind also that firms remit their monies back to their home countries. McDonald's, General Motors, Ford, they remit monies back to the U.S. And if we started thinking that they have to keep the monies that they made in China or Nigeria in those countries, we'd have some out.
Probably fewer franchises overseas.
Yeah, so the money's remitted back here. So you got to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. If you go overseas and you or I go work and we get a salary, bring back the money to the U.S., and the firms do the same thing. So there's no objection there. I think most people say, yes, it's their money. They do what they want. So if General Motors makes money and profits in Beijing, Shanghai, and they want to bring the money back and put it in Detroit, that's up to them, and we would welcome that. Mm-hmm. To start making restrictions on where people move money, I think, is a really huge error, and we don't want to see that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jody in Benton. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Chris. I'd like to ask the panel to comment on the cost of legal immigration into the United States. My family spent about $20,000 in lawyer fees with engineering company that my dad worked for in a management level job. And I was moved here as a minor, and we went for an interview and paid $7,000 just to have a lawyer accompany me. And I still don't have a green card because they denied me. And I'm in school currently and still have no way to work or assimilate into the country.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call.
No problem.
I can address this issue. I wrote a book with Madeline Zavodny that came out last year and called Beside the Golden Door, and we discuss U.S. immigration reform. We have a proposal, and my friend who's an immigration lawyer, he jokes that he goes, well, I'm glad I'll be retired by the time that, you know, your proposal gets implemented.
The idea is to put them out of work.
The idea is to put the immigration lawyers out of work by making a transparent and efficient immigration system, because what it really has become is unbelievably complex and convoluted. And it's wrong on so many counts, the way we do legal immigration in this country, not just, you know, unauthorized immigration, but legal immigration. I think the biggest travesty is really how we stick people in queues. So whether you're employment-based or family-based, if you're in these capped categories where there's a visa quota, in most categories there is, people are standing in decade-long queues. And people sometimes, just from the virtue of being from a populous country, because we have country quota, so if you're from China, Mexico, the Philippines, India, you're stuck in the longest queues because there's so many people in line, and we restrict the number of people from, you know, to be equal across countries, regardless of their home population. There's so many things that are wrong with how we do immigration policies.
I would just say one word in defense of the lawyers. I know they are expensive, and we have a very, very complicated legal system. But as complicated and inefficient as it is, it does have, I would argue, an element of flexibility in it. And this may seem like an unfair statement, but if you do have the money and the wherewithal and you're persistent, I mean, you can often get your case heard. You can have it adjudicated. And a large number of people who do get settled in the United States legally are able to bypass this archaic visa system we have by adjusting their status. One of my colleagues, again, Phil Martin, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, said we have an adjustment of status immigration policy.
What does that mean?
Adjustment of status simply means that you get in the U.S. somehow and you get yourself a lawyer and you look for loopholes and ways to get yourself regularized or legalized. So there are a lot of individuals who succeed in doing that. I see Pia shaking her head over here.
Is that like buying your? Is that like buying your way in?
It is in a way. It is like buying your way in. And you know, I know this sounds funny to defend the system, but I'm thinking in contrast with Europe, for example, where a lot of immigrants don't have these options. You know, they may be pushed further and further underground. And you know, I agree with Pia that this is an inefficient system. That it's that we should be reforming it. We should be adopting a more rational immigration policy. But in contrast with a lot of other countries, I mean, there are avenues and opportunities here for changing your status, adjusting your status, moving from one category to another. So I'll let Pia respond to that.
Yeah, as one whose family got here dirt poor, I'm curious about the perspective of the rest of
I think I could add that the only system that's worse in the U.S. is the tax system. It's more complicated. I mean, everyone's
maybe the least controversial thing that's been said today.
Yeah, taxes. Everyone agrees it's incomprehensible. Even those that are educated can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. The legal system for immigration is also equally, one step below it.
Yeah.
But as Jim was saying, in Europe and other places, it's a very, very different system. Mm-hmm. We have to point out that many people are paying tens of thousands of dollars to enter countries.
Yeah.
And once they get here, then they have to pay again if they wish.
Yeah.
But even if they fail in their attempts, many of them stay. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a very, very confusing and difficult situation. And I'm very sympathetic to people like Jody and others that are going through this thing. You have to pay an enormous amount. The system's not fair. It's unclear what's going on.
Yep.
It's a game that everyone's playing. And human lives, especially young people, are suffering as a consequence.
Okay, so Jim is right that, you know, it's always good to have some discretion and flexibility. And so I see that there is a role for lawyers, obviously, in our complex system. But let's get back to the point that Jim made. Then this is where we disagree. And he says that people can come in, you know, in an unauthorized capacity or illegally and then adjust status. This is no longer the case. At least it's not the case anymore for people who cross the border illegally. If you come with a visa and you overstay, yes, you can still – there are ways to do this, to adjust status and become a permanent resident. Mm-hmm. But there is no longer possible with people who cross the border illegally, and this is why. In 1996, in 1996, Congress passed and the president signed these immigration bars, which are – basically say, okay, so if you're an illegal immigrant, you cross the border illegally, you came in. Let's say you married a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. Before 1996, you could have adjusted status because you are allowed a permanent resident visa under the law if you're married to a U.S. citizen. That's a family category. But under the 1996 bars, what they say is you have to, if you came illegally, in order to collect your documentation to clear your green card, you have to go back to your home country. Mm-hmm. Well, you go back to your home country to collect your papers at the consulate, and then when you're trying to come back, a bar applies, and it's a 10-year bar, and you have to wait 10 years to reenter the U.S. So really, it's no longer possible, and it's a huge problem, and it's something that people are not talking about, nearly enough.
Could I ask Pia just one point of information? How many of the illegal immigrants do we have a percentage that are visa overstayers as opposed to people who cross the border clandestinely? I know some estimates of that. Do you have an idea?
Yeah, the rule of thumb is 40-60, so 40% of unauthorized immigrants are visa overstayers and 60% are border crossers.
Mm-hmm.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Dave in Dallas. Hey, Dave.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, okay. My question was, well, kind of repetition is that basically, like, if you are married to an American citizen and you entered, you know, legally and all that, and how long can they keep your case pending without a valid reason given back to them? Or is there anything that's been done to, you know, fix up issue or something like that?
If you came in illegally?
I guess.
Or legally?
Let's confirm that. Did you mean if you come in legally or illegally?
Legally.
Legally. And you're married to a U.S. citizen. Is that your question?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I would know. You have to ask one of Jim Hollifield's immigration lawyers. sense is that the USCIS is known for taking their time, and there's nothing we can do about it.
It really depends how much you pay the lawyer. If you get a good lawyer, first credit lawyer, you can get it done in a couple of weeks, probably.
A lot can happen in this country with the right attorney. We have an email here from Pedro who wants to know what all of you think about the possibility of having the DREAM Act passed prior to the next election.
Zero.
Zero.
Yes, I guess so.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Pedro. And his second question was the possibility of married same-sex couples, this came up briefly earlier, having a partner naturalized.
I mentioned that earlier. Currently, there are about 10 countries in the world that have legal same-sex marriage, and several others recognize those performed abroad. The U.S. is right now going through a legal battle in California and other states and Massachusetts, and this will no doubt go to the Supreme Court because we have the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed by Congress and signed by the President some 15, 20 years ago, and now we're running against the issue of what's legal, what's not legal, and we have six states, roughly, Washington, D.C. included, that have legalized same-sex marriage. And now we're having cases where Americans marry same-sex partners abroad and they want to bring them back in the country. This is now in the legal battle. It'll take some time to work out, as we saw in California, but it will be probably taken to the Supreme Court.
So we're back to the lawyers again, Chris.
Yes.
Well, they're not going to be out of work anytime soon. All right. We just have about 2 minutes left. And so I want to ask, in terms of immigration trends, things on the horizon, let's just say we'll talk about for this country, what are we likely to see that we have not yet seen?
In terms of trends, well, we've seen two different things really out of sort of currently what's going on, at least in terms of what the government is doing. I mean, one trend is in terms of worksite enforcement, not to go after workers, but rather to go after employers. So that's a big change. Another trend is more restrictions on low-skilled labor visas. So we've seen tightening regulations on things like H-2A visas and H-2B visas pending as well. So some tighter restrictions on labor migration on the low-skilled end. But recently, some relaxation of rules regarding high-skilled, particularly foreign students who can stay and do an internship, for example, after their graduate study. So some relaxation of those rules. So I think the trend going forward is going to be probably more emphasis on high-skilled immigration, how to let in more high-skilled immigrants, and how to slowly bring our immigration policy into more balance.
I think the U.S. is going to follow the same pattern we're seeing in Europe, which is a move to the right. The public in all these countries wants to see less immigration, not simply illegal, but legal as well, less immigration. The governments that are in power, many of them want more immigrants to come in for economic and other reasons, and the public is therefore moving toward groups on the right, extremist groups in France and Sweden, Italy, Germany, the UK, and the U.S. We're going to see this trend, a movement to the right, because the governments that are now in power are not adequately addressing the issue that's of concern to the public.
And that becomes our last word. Apologies to Jim Hollifield, who is director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at SMU. We just heard from Joseph Shammy, director of the Center for Migration Studies in New York, and Pierre Arrhenius is our third guest, research officer and senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. All three are taking part this week in the conference called Immigration Policy in an Era of Globalization. Find information on the Think page of KERA.org. It's been great to have all of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.